Chapter 37. Imposters. "We imposters, sir, are unaccountable people." The speaker was a large, shambling man, Ferdinand Waldo Demara, whose exploits had been on the front page of every American newspaper. At the beginning of the Korean War, he had presented himself at a Royal Canadian Navy recruiting office and introduced himself as Dr. Joseph Sear, anxious to serve his country. His medical knowledge was non-existent. Nevertheless, as a lieutenant surgeon, he served in the battle zone, tended wounded men, and actually performed surgical operations, successful ones. When a chief medical officer noticed that he was poor at diagnosis, he maintained his imposture by putting all the cases he couldn't diagnose in a special quarantine room in the bowels of the ship, where his chief never saw them or knew of their existence. By pumping penicillin into his patients, he got through his 6-month career in the Navy without killing any of them. It sounds like the average man's idea of hell, a kind of sick comedy dragged out to agonising lengths. So why did Demara do it? Not out of any desire for gain, but because he had a craving to be somebody, to be saluted and respected. He knew the imposture had to end, that he had to go back to being just plain Ferd Demara with no qualifications. That didn't matter. The craving of the ego was too strong. He cared for the future about as much as a sex maniac contemplating rape. The true imposter, a man like Ferd Demara, must be clearly distinguished from the swindler or the confidence man, who's simply out to make a comfortable living by taking in suckers. It's true that there are borderline cases. For example, the Romanian adventurer George Manolescu, whose flamboyant career was the inspiration for Maurice Leblanc's Arsène Lupin, the gentleman burglar turned crime fighter, and the novelist Thomas Mann's confidence man, Felix Krull. As Prince Lavery, Manolescu breezed through the European salons and grand hotels of the late 19th century, leaving a trail of broken hearts and empty jewel cases. The fact remains that Manolescu adopted his career for the money and the sex rather than for the ego satisfaction it provided. The same goes for the extraordinary Count Victor Lustig, the man who sold the Eiffel Tower to a group of Parisian scrap merchants. On the other hand, the true imposter, men like George Salmananza, Stanley Wyman, Ferdinand Demara, are frustrated artists whose deceits are almost a form of creativity. If they happen to make money through the imposture, it's purely a byproduct. The first great imposter on historical record seems to be the 9th century Pope, John VIII. According to the historian Platina, who was the Vatican librarian, Pope John was actually a woman called Joanna, who spent most of her life disguised as a man. Her story has been told in a book called Pope Joan by the Greek novelist Emmanuel Roidis, who was excommunicated for his pains. According to Roidis, Joanna was born at Metz in France, where her mother, a peasant girl named Judith, happened to be staying with her current lover. It was after this that Judith was raped by 2 Saxon archers and then gave birth to Joanna. A wandering English monk who had earlier been castrated by savage German tribesmen met the couple and offered to become Joanna's father. On Judith's death, he trained his adopted daughter to be a kind of quiz kid. Her memory was phenomenal. The monk would take her to a castle and invite the father confessor there to examine the girl in any branch of human knowledge, from theology to cookery. When her father died, Joanna decided that her future lay in the church. The trouble was that nuns were expected to be seen and not heard, so Joanna decided to be a monk. This was after she had met a holy father called Frumentius, helped him to copy out the epistles of St. Paul, and become his mistress. The forbidden lovers travelled around Europe, staying in monasteries. Joanna's brilliance in theological disputation made her welcome everywhere. She studied for a while in Athens, then went on to Rome, where she met with few that could equal, much less go beyond her, in knowledge of the scriptures. As Father John, she became a member of the papal household, an instructor in theology at the school of San Martino. 2 years later, when Pope Leo IV died in 855 AD, she had enough influence and support to become the newly elected Pope, John VIII. During the next 2 years, she crowned the Emperor Louis, ordained 14 bishops, built 5 churches, wrote 3 books, and added an article to the creed. Then she fell in love with a young monk, whose business was to sleep next to the papal bedchamber, and seduced him. As a result, she became pregnant. This was not too difficult to conceal. The papal robes were voluminous. However, her love life and her pregnancy caused her to neglect her ecclesiastical duties to such an extent that her enemies began to plan her overthrow. a plague of locusts increased her problems, and the people became restive. Then, as she was leading a procession to the Lateran church to pray for an end to the plague, she collapsed, gave birth to the baby, and died shortly afterwards. She had then been Pope for 3 years. Pope Nicholas I was appointed in her place, and ecclesiastical historians tried so conscientiously to wipe out her memory that the next Pope John, who should have been John IX, was given the title John VIII. According to the Church, the story of Pope Joan is just an amusing, if embarrassing, legend, but it persisted throughout the Middle Ages, and Plotino recorded it in his Lives of the Popes. There's certainly a short gap between the death of Leo IV and the accession of Benedict II in 855. Roiidis, although he wrote his book in semi-fictional form, insists upon its basic accuracy and quotes an impressive list of medieval authorities for it. Even so, the Church still denies her existence. If she existed, then she was undoubtedly the greatest impostor of all time, one might say the patron saint of impostors. Another intriguing historical mystery surrounds another Joan, Joan of Arc. Burned at the stake in May 1431, she seems to have reappeared a few years later and married a nobleman named Robert des Amois. At first sight, this sounds like another of the typical legends about famous people who have touched the public imagination. But the documentary evidence is very impressive indeed, so much so that the author Anatole France devotes the last 2 chapters of his Life of the Maid to it. 5 years after the maid had been burned at the stake, a girl claiming to be Joan appeared in a village near Metz. She was about the right age, 25. Joan's 2 young brothers went to see her and immediately recognised her as their sister. In the same year, the town councillors of Rouen received a letter from Joan announcing her survival. A former herald was sent to identify her and agreed that she was Joan. It's a historical fact that the memorial services which had been held for her since her death were discontinued in 1436. According to a court chamberlain named de Boissy, a girl who claimed to be the maid came to the court of Charles VII, whom Joan had crowned king, and proved her identity to the king by telling him a secret that only he and Joan of Arc knew. This girl, however, later confessed to being an impostor called Jean Laferon and begged forgiveness for the deception. Which would seem to dispose of the legend of the survival of the Maid of Orléans, except that her family, not only her brothers, continued to accept her as the true Joan. The account books of the town of Orléans show that Jean des Amois was given a civic reception on account of the good she did to the said town during the siege of 1429. Since this happened a mere 10 years after the siege, it seems inconceivable that a false Joan could have deceived her old comrades in arms as to her identity. Finally, the scholar Albert Bayet, who discovered the marriage certificate of Joan and Robert des Amois in a lawyer's archives in 1907, declared that the signature Jahan was identical with the signature of a letter written to the citizens of Rheims in the year before the maid's death at the stake. Either Jean Laferon was a brilliant impostor who could deceive Joan's own relatives and comrades in arms, or the real Joan was quietly spirited away from prison in 1431 and some unfortunate substitute burned in her place. But it now seems unlikely that the truth will ever be known. With the career of George Salmanaza, impostordom moves out of the realms of historical conjecture into those of well-attested fact. Born in Gascony in 1679, Salmanaza, who took his name from the Assyrian king Shalmaneser, was an adventurer, like his contemporary Casanova. It may have been his small stature and sallow complexion that gave him the idea of posing as a Japanese who had been converted to Christianity. He was about 20 when he visited Rome and discovered that his pose as a Japanese convert opened the doors of the pious rich and kept his stomach filled. He then went to London and introduced himself to the Bishop of London, who was so impressed by him that he paid him to translate the catechism into Japanese. Needless to say, Salmanaza did not speak a word of Japanese, but he translated it into some kind of gobbledygook, and since Japan was still virtually an unknown realm, no one was in a position to contradict him. To make the deception more foolproof, he explained that he was actually a native of Formosa. In 1704, at the age of 25, he wrote his historical and geographical description of Formosa, which was pure fiction. He was introduced to royalty, and the Bishop of London sent him to Oxford to teach the Formosan language to would-be missionaries at Christchurch. Salmanaza burned a candle in his window all night to give the impression that he was studying. He met a great many scholars and notables, including Hans Sloane, Secretary of the Royal Society, Lord Pembroke, and the Russian minister, and fooled them all. It was the astronomer Halley who was his downfall. Halley asked him some simple scientific questions, such as how long the twilight lasted in Formosa, and the sun's position at noon. Salmanaza's replies convinced Halley he was an impostor. The impression gradually spread, and the Gascon suddenly found himself in obscurity again. He might have vanished silently from public knowledge, like so many of his kind, but at this point he was suddenly overtaken by yet another religious conversion. This was around 1712. Whether it was genuine, no one will ever know, but it certainly served his purpose. In an age when volumes of sermons were bestsellers, the repentant Salmanaza was almost as great an attraction as the former convert from the distant East. He made a living by hack journalism and held court at a public house in Old Street, London, where his pious discourse attracted many celebrities, including the young Samuel Johnson, who later said that Salmanaza was the best man he had ever known. Clearly what Salmanaza wanted, and what he got, was a reputation and a way of making a living. This is something that must be borne in mind when discussing impostors. The world is a difficult place. Neither money nor fame comes easily to most. For every pop singer who makes a fortune overnight, there are a few thousand hard-working men of talent who achieve it only after years of training and effort. But it's always the pop singers and their like who impress the general public, these and the impostors. The impostor may be a man of real talent, as Salmanaza obviously was. To begin with, he was an excellent linguist. But he lacks the one-track mind that carries so many men of talent to final success. He feels that he ought to have been born rich and successful. In fact, he almost certainly possesses the qualities necessary for success, imagination and ambition, but he makes the fatal mistake of trying to achieve his aim by deception. And so, as far as lasting success goes, he has started out on the wrong foot. This was vividly demonstrated by one of the most remarkable of modern impostors, Stanley Wyman, who is the subject of an excellent book by the American writer Sinclair McKelvey. Wyman was born Stephen Jacob Weinberg in Brooklyn in 1890. A typical example of his imagination and enterprise is the way he introduced Princess Fatima of Afghanistan to President Harding. One morning in July 1921, Weinberg, or Wyman as he preferred to call himself, read in his morning paper that Princess Fatima had come to New York with her family, hoping to meet the president. However, various problems of diplomatic protocol stood in the way. In a flash of audacious inspiration, Wyman decided to effect the introduction himself. He dressed himself up in naval uniform and went to the princess's hotel, the Waldorf Astoria. A few days later, an assistant secretary of state got a call from Rodney S. Wyman, the State Department naval liaison officer, telling him that Princess Fatima was agreeable to meeting President Harding in a couple of days. There was, in fact, no such thing as a naval liaison officer at the State Department. Wyman telephoned the White House and made an appointment, the officials there assuming it had been made by the State Department. He then marched up to the front door with Princess Fatima and her entourage and performed the introductions. It was as simple as that. Wyman profited from his deception to the sum of a few $100 given to him by the princess for expenses incurred in the Washington trip. It was one of the few occasions when he made money from his impostures. The subsequent exposure of this piece of enterprise cost Wyman a fine of $1 and 2 years in jail, a sad ending to an affair that seems to be essentially a harmless joke. However, it was typical of Wyman's lifelong bad luck. His exploits may qualify as a kind of creative art, but he never received the kind of reward that society bestows on some of its more creative artists. In a way, he was profoundly stupid. But what motivated him to spend his life involved in a series of deceptions? Wyman was a bright and intelligent young man, and his father was a fairly successful estate broker. His trouble was that he was too ambitious. He wanted to become a diplomat, a doctor, and a lawyer. His father, a self-made man, thought this was too ambitious. He wanted the boy to show he was capable of making good in some ordinary business and then go on to university or to medical school. The young Wyman went to work for a real estate firm, conceived marvellous plans for its improvement, and tried hard to persuade his bosses to let him put them into practice. His employers proved too cautious, however, so he left. He then worked for a professional photographer, had a misunderstanding and walked out, taking an expensive camera. He became thoroughly frustrated about his father's understandable refusal to send him to Princeton until he had shown himself capable of sticking at a job. One day, therefore, he made a typical gesture. He sent out dozens of invitation cards to celebrities and public notables, asking them to attend a banquet at the St. George Hotel, Brooklyn, in honour of the new United States Consul General to Algiers, Clifford Weinberg. The banquet, charged to his father, was a great success. Wyman basked in the congratulations of the celebrities present. A judge who was present invited him to sit with him on the bench the next day, and Wyman graciously accepted. While he was sitting there, a photographer was called in to take a picture of the judge and the consul general. It turned out to be Wyman's former employer, who indignantly denounced the consul and accused him of stealing an expensive camera from his store. Wyman admitted the charge and ruefully confessed that the banquet had been intended as a gesture to force his father to send him to Princeton. It didn't work. His father paid the $400 bill, grimly, and also the bail to keep his son out of prison. But Wyman got probation for the theft of the camera and spent 6 months in a psychiatric hospital. It seems likely that if Wyman had persisted in his ambition to become a doctor at all costs, he would have succeeded. Instead, he went into journalism as a cub reporter. That might have been acceptable, too, if he had continued to report to his probation officer. But his pride revolted at the idea. He was arrested and spent 8 months in reformatories. When he was released, the newspaper refused to give him his job back. He worked for a time as a freelance journalist, but continued to go back to jail for violation of parole. The urge to play act became more compulsive, although it was harmless enough. He married when he was 30. He and his wife would then dress up in their best evening clothes to go to an expensive restaurant and let it be known that the Consul General from Algiers was there. The attention of the waiters and the manager would be balm to his soul. He would pay his bill and go home, his ego temporarily satisfied. At times, however, the longing to be somebody would become unbearable when he read about some celebrity in a newspaper. In 1926, shortly after the death of Rudolph Valentino, Wyman heard that the film star Paula Negri, who claimed to be engaged to Valentino, was in New York. He called on her at her hotel, introduced himself as an old friend of Rudy's, and said that he had decided to be Miss Negri's personal physician while she was in New York. She liked him and invited him to move into the spare bedroom of her hotel suite. For a few weeks, he was a man of importance, giving interviews to columnists, acting as PRO for Valentino's manager, and playing a leading part in the organisation of the actor's showpiece funeral, which, needless to say, drew hordes of hysterical women. When reporters recognised him as an impostor and denounced him, Miss Negri declined to throw him out. She said that whether he was a real doctor or not, he was the best medical man she'd ever had. Since Wyman had committed no offence, no criminal charges resulted from this escapade. In August 1960, Wyman was working as a night clerk in a Yonkers hotel when two gunmen tried to snatch the cash box. Unarmed though he was, Wyman apparently tried to attack them. His body was later found on the floor in front of the reception desk. The cash box was still intact. It was a brave, useless action, and some psychologists might say it was a form of suicide, or the gesture of a man who was willing to risk his life for a brief burst of fame and glory. The final verdict on him, as on so many other impostors, is that he was a living version of James Thurber's Walter Mitty, a dreamer who could never learn the trick of harnessing his fantasies to reality. So he became not only a pest and a menace to other people, but also a self-destructive danger to himself.